Mindfulness, as a core principle of Buddhist psychology, is friendly, present, moment-to-moment awareness of whatever your direct experience is. So when you're mindful of your own somatic reactions, you start to learn the language of your body, and you can kind of reread what's kind of happening with you, and then you can pause and slow down.
83% of Americans identify as not very happy, which can hold you back and negatively affect your relationships and your business. On this podcast, we discuss the proven steps to happiness so you can restore balance and rekindle your joy.
Welcome to another edition of How to Be Happier for Entrepreneurs. We have a pretty special guest and a really awesome topic. Welcome, Francesca. How are you?
I'm good, Brad. How are you?
I'm exceptional. We are going to be talking about mindfulness and how we bring mindfulness into therapy. Francesca has had some incredible experience. And as we always do, we jump right in. So we're going to start with a topic a little different from mindfulness, but something that I've come across in the last couple of months that you know a lot about that I'm absolutely fascinated with. And that is memory reconsolidation. It's just been about, 20 years since they figured this out. How is it impacting our self-perception and past experience of therapy?
Thanks for asking, Brad. I guess that's kind of how you found me in the first place, right? You were doing a little bit of research on memory reconsolidation, and you'd seen that I had interviewed Bruce Ecker. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm curious, before I answer the question, I'm curious, when you were learning about memory reconsolidation, what about it was fascinating for you, or what did you find to be compelling?
The most fascinating thing is, like, I feel like this gentleman cracked the code to, here's how you can have transformative healing in a relatively quick time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it works across all different modalities. That was just like, wow.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that is what kind of piqued your interest. So I am not a neuroscientist. I am a psychotherapist. I am a licensed psychotherapist. I'm also a life coach and a somatic experiencing practitioner. And I'm also certified in a variety of other modalities like focusing oriented therapy and internal family systems and things like that, that all kind of are different therapeutic modalities, holistic modalities, somatic modalities that all kind of have different ways, including mindfulness and sort of Buddhist psychology based modalities, that all sort of point to a bottom-up way of knowing and understanding what is our experience and how it's held in the body and the ideas and narratives and actions that come from that, and then how to retouch into them in a way using our imagination and a combination of that with our actual direct memory of an experience to kind of allow the neural synapses in our brain that were kind of fused together at a certain point in time to kind of open up a little bit and to have, through our own imagination, a different experience through our recreation of it. We call it like a corrective experience that we talk about in a therapeutic encounter or a coaching encounter that the person who's the client comes up with and creates. An example might be, Dad at the dinner table used to yell at me when I would bring home a B from school at the report card. And this one time when he did it, he pounded the table so hard that the table broke. And ever since then, I went into my room and I vowed that I would never get a B again. And so I've been a workaholic top performer, reading all the books and being the expert type A person, getting into the Ivy League top business schools, and yet my marriage is suffering, my children and I don't have a good relationship, I'm kind of unhappy, but this is what is driving it, right? Like that original memory of the fear of the father's anger coupled with the longing for the father's attachment and approval get all kind of commingled in that place, stuck around that dinner table. And so when we bring up this old memory, and we kind of touch into it with a little bit of curiosity, I'd say, well, what would you want to have happen in that experience? What didn't happen? Who or what might have been resources there that could have maybe possibly been more supportive? And I'll ask people anything, as unicorns, deities, fuzzy animals, superheroes, who or what could have maybe talked to your dad in a way that at that time your mom couldn't or you couldn't or whatever, that might have made it a little bit easier for him to say, oh, he's just a kid, or yeah, it's a B this time, but that doesn't mean that he has to be scolded or whatever it is. And those resources brought into that experience can help hold the child as the adult is going through this process in his own mind, can help hold the child in such a way that he doesn't feel so alone, so that when the adult is actually now reflecting back on that experience, he feels differently about it. He doesn't feel as isolated alone. He doesn't feel as different. And that reconsolidation of a new memory, a new neural synapse, a new learning, he has a new emotional learning now that has pulled apart threat with connection, that he can be maybe academically inclined out of choice, but not as a way to necessarily escape the threat of anger of his father. And from that place, he can go back and have humility and repair with his wife and be able to have communication with his kids and be able to say, you know, I'm sorry, I've been really tied up with work and I haven't been as available, because he's not sitting there saying, oh my God, if I don't work to the bone, then I'm a nothing in life.
Right.
Does this make sense in terms of how the process?
Yeah. I mean, that was a really cool example. And I guess what else asked me what fascinated me about it? I kind of knew this, but it was said in a completely different light. So we'll call his workaholism and suffering marriage as a symptom, right? Mm-hmm. And that you could come up with 1,000 different symptoms, whether it's someone's eating patterns or abusive or anger or drugs or whatever, right? But all of those quote symptoms are really a solution to what the brain thinks is keeping it from something worse. And in the example you gave, the example worse is my dad is going to get mad and he doesn't love me. That to me is fascinating. So all of these folks who have been told they had a disorder or something's wrong with their brain, I look at that and say, no, there's nothing wrong with your brain. It's doing what it should be doing, right? It's protecting, it's taking you from pain to pleasure. Is that correct?
It's doing its best from a child's perspective of how it can support or protect you or prevent further injury. It's doing its best from that adaptive place. It becomes maladaptive when it continues to be the reflexive go-to long after its utility has expired, because a 40-year-old man is no longer at the dinner table with dad. But we carry that, we call it emotional truth, with us long into our adult life sometimes, and only when things hit a breaking point and it stops working for us in the way that it did, does kind of things fall apart. And then we sort of say, okay, well, I got to call someone and maybe get some help or whatever. And the reason why it's different from cognitive therapy, I mean, it uses your brain and your mind, obviously, but the reason why it's different from, oh, I think that because I'm spending all my time at work, that's why my marriage is suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, but it doesn't honor the emotional truth of why a part of you needs, from its perspective, to spend time at work, because doing that keeps you safe and connected to and from your dad.
And why do we as human beings hold on to those emotional truths so, or those emotional learnings so long?
Usually what happens is when we have a holding environment of connection early on, what we would call a repair, a soft landing, an accompaniment, an attunement, a presence with a non-judgmental, non-critical, loving presence, it doesn't necessarily stick. So if, for example, that kid's best friend was at the dinner table, or if his mom had more capacity and could have pulled him aside afterwards and said, Johnny, I really just want you to know that it's not okay what your dad did. And I don't know what story you're telling yourself right now, but a B is not a failure. And you're always my gem. And if there's anything you want to talk about school, because you want to do differently, I can do homework with you, or we can work with a tutor. But I just want you to know that I love you as you are. And you mean a lot to me. And I wish we could change dad, but I'm going to talk to him. And I don't want you to have to take this on. There's no guarantee,
right,
that even if she did that it would make him not have this belief. But I think it would probably make him not have that belief as deeply for as long as he did.
Wow. So interesting. Man, this stuff fascinates me. So switching kind of into the Buddhist teachings, because I know you have a great background in that. How do Buddhist teachings influence your methods in psychotherapy and coaching today?
One of the great gifts that I've received from my primary mentor, Jack Kornfield, and Tara Brach, and a variety of other Vipassana Theravadin Buddhist practitioners, and also Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, and other spiritual leaders that talk about different lineages like Vedanta and Hinduism and whatnot, but primarily Buddhist psychology, is this way of examining and studying the science of the mind. Like, it's this business of being able to observe, be with, and accompany, be curious in a friendly way with our emotions, with our experiences, with whatever it is that's happening with us. Oftentimes, we're so blended, we're so close to what our emotions are, what our feelings are, that we drown and then we feel completely overwhelmed by them. And when we start to do what one of my clients says, kind of be on the observation deck and kind of take notice of what's happening in our bodies, and the way that I work is somatically. So first we name that as a sensation. Like, people are like, I'm anxious. And I'm like, well, what is anxiety really for you as a sensation? Is it a tightness in your chest? Is it a sinking feeling in your belly? What color is it? Is it gray? What texture is it? Is it like concrete? Is it like lava? Is it up in your throat? Oh yeah, tightness in my throat. Really, is that a squeezing in? Is that like a pushing out tight? And I ask all these weird questions because it helps people get in touch with what the somatic signal is in their body that precedes the narrative and that precedes the reflective action. And so mindfulness, as a core principle of Buddhist psychology, is friendly, present, moment-to-moment awareness of whatever your direct experience is. So when you're mindful of your own somatic reactions, you start to learn the language of your body, and you can kind of pre-read what's kind of happening with you, and then you can pause and slow down. Take a few breaths, then you can decide what to do or not to do. You're not just doing that automatic reaction. Because most people that get into a fight with their partner, they're like, I couldn't help it. I blew up. I threw the thing against the wall already, or I yelled at her, but I didn't mean to. Or even their inner critic. They're like, I was off on a tangent telling myself what a shitty person I was and how awful I am. And actually, when we start to learn the language of the body, it's almost like those railroad crossing signals that go ding, 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 and the red lights flash before the train comes through. That's our body telling us what's happening before the train comes and hits us. So we don't want the train to hit us. We want to wait over here and give a little bit of time, let it do its thing. That's activation in the body. The autonomic nervous system gets hyper-aroused or hyper-aroused. And then we allow that to happen and it'll eventually settle. And then our prefrontal cortex comes back online. We're no longer flooded with that activation, that injection of cortisol or whatever. And then we're able to make sense of our experience and not just get caught up in it because we're so flooded by it or blended with it. That's what mindfulness and Buddhist psychology are rooted in, is the ability to accompany with a friendly curiosity what our experience is, the science of the mind.
I don't know if it's Tara Brock who said this, but if you label your emotion and say, I am feeling, then it actually kind of forces you from the amygdala to the prefrontal cortex because you got to think like, hey, what is it I'm feeling? I think someone said that. I don't know if it was her or not.
Yeah. Peter Levine from Somatic Experiencing uses a slightly different version of that. He says, I'm having the thought that so-and-so doesn't like me. I'm having the thought that if I don't pay my electric bill on time, that I'll get evicted. I'm having the thought that, which is different from me being evicted and having a panic attack because I don't have that $50 in my account.
Right.
Like, you're able to kind of, in a way, calm your nervous system because you're creating that space between your awareness of what is happening with your ability to observe that. So Buddhist principles, I find enormously helpful in all aspects of coaching and therapy. Some of the core tenets are that nothing is permanent, nothing is perfect, and nothing is personal. So everything changes, everything passes. It's sort of like the weather. There are days that are sunny, that are days that are cloudy, days that are rainy, days that are stormy, whatever. There's different weather patterns, and that no 2 days are the same, right? And that it's not personal, meaning I don't say, oh, it's raining today because I'm a bad person, or it's sunny today because I'm a good person, or it's, I don't take it personally, right? And that also nothing is perfect, that it's not always going to be a sunny day, right? Like, that there are days when it's going to be rainy or snowy, and that the practice of mindfulness enables us to notice what we call our Vedana, or a feeling tone. I may prefer a sunny day, I may like a sunny day over a snowy day or a rainy day, but my attitude toward the weather also impacts my experience. So the moment that I have an awareness of what I'm feeling and how I'm thinking about it, I like the sunny, I hate the cloudy, then I can say, oh, They're just different experiences. Like red and blue are just two different colors. They're not better or worse than the other one.
Right.
And that is part of our ticket to freedom, because when we, again, pull apart our preferences or our aversions from the actual experience, and we start to be able to practice seeing experience for what it is. Today is raining. Today is sunny. I like the sun. I don't like the rain. Just because I don't like the rain and I like the sun does not mean that the rain is bad and the sun is good.
Right.
See where we're going with this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you find it fascinating that neuroscience is coming up with some new things that Buddhists, and it's been around for thousands of years, like Ayurvedic and all that? Have you noticed how?
Yes, I've noticed. And I mean, I guess there's nothing new under the sun, and we're a part of the universe, part of the flow of experience. We're not sort of like little separate things. We're part of this flow. It makes sense in its own way. And we try to cut in and understand it from all these different perspectives. But if you look at music or physics or fractals or Fibonacci sequences and Hinduism and Buddhism and different snowflakes, fungi, mycelium, birds, feathers, trees, aortas, veins, and the lungs, there's all kinds of similarities and random things that aren't random, that it entirely makes sense to me that some of the Ayurvedic principles are the same as the Buddhist principles, or the same as some of this stuff. It's all repackaged. I mean, this idea of memory reconsolidation is just another name for something that Eugene Gendlin, who was focusing oriented therapy pioneer, who's actually a philosopher and not a founder, but he sort of coined the term the felt sense. It's just sort of his way of naming when we have a bodily knowing, an intuition, a sense of our own ownership of the emotional truth of an experience, that we are able to use that to inform what wants to move forward and emerge next for us in our life. And that in a Western sort of imperialist kind of society, we're forced to kind of tamp that down a lot and kind of be more of a sheeple and kind of follow along and kind of cut ourselves off. And sati, or mindfulness, or remembering, is a way of reconnecting that. That is the process of starting to rethread and retread that. And all these other practices like yoga and Tai Chi and whatever help do that reconnection.
If you were explaining to a seventh grader how we're all one, how would you do that?
I didn't say we're all one. I said we're all part of the flow of experience.
Do you believe that we're all one? I mean, you hear that's a, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm in this space now, but we're all one.
No, not necessarily. I don't know that I mean, maybe it's a way of parsing something that, I don't think so, because if we're all one, to me, that imagines that we're some kind of an entity. And I don't think we are one specific entity. I think we're part of the flow of experience. The flow of experience is limitless. It's not static. So we're not separate from anything. And yet, in the absolute world, in the sort of larger cosmic sense, we're not separate from anything. But in the relative world, yeah, we have individual personalities. We're on this lifespan of a 70-year to 100-year journey, if we're lucky, or something like that. And that we're necessarily all connected in the sense that clearly we perpetuate one another. Sperm, egg, meat, babies come. This baby meets that baby. 20 years later, they have a new baby. Like, and so what would I say to a seventh grader about we are all one? I don't really know if that's how I would parse it. I would probably say each one of us is interdependent and related in a way that is part of the fabric of the flow of experience.
Do you believe we're all energy, or like everything's energy?
Well, beliefs are hardened thoughts, and I don't really have any beliefs. I have sort of my own direct experience around what I experience, which is more along the lines of, if we talk about matter and waves and heat and movement and those kinds of things, if we're talking about energy consisting of that, then certainly there are times when, yes, there's that combination that produces some energy. But air and stillness, the space between notes in a Mozart concerto, are those energy, or is that space? If that's space, what is that space? That implies that it's contained by something, but it's not really. Is that a groundlessness? I think so. So what does that mean? That means that it's infinite. So I don't know. I wouldn't want to compartmentalize everything as just energy either necessarily.
So you probably know this better than I do. Hasn't science proven like everything is energy, whether it's the table or the chair or us or a cell phone, like just particles of...
That's matter. Yeah. I mean, you could look at it that way. And I'm saying that you're talking about things, you're talking about material, right? And as you break down things further and further, they become not static, they become waves in motion. And so, yes, that can be energetic. And then there's also just space. We have dark matter. We don't know what that is. We have, I don't know. I think there's a lot of mystery out there.
Yeah.
And I certainly am not the one who's going to be able to say certain things. And even if it were all energy or wasn't all energy, I don't know how that would help me understand how to navigate my life any better or worse. I mean, it's a fun philosophical discussion, but yeah. I don't know that it would help.
Yeah, I guess that would, if I was explaining it, and look, you've got more knowledge than I do on the subject. You've been in this field for so, so long, and you've done so many great things. But if we're all energy and we all came from the same creator, may we all be one? Like you said, it's a difficult question, but something fun to ponder.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's we all came from the same creator or we are one. That wouldn't necessarily be my language. I think we are part of a continuum of the flow of experience, and how we exist in that or what manifests to one another about that is as much to do with the one who is perceiving as the one who is acting and offering.
Right. So you help a lot of people and you've helped a lot of people. What alternative methods do you suggest for those seeking emotional healing beyond traditional Western medicine?
I mean, if we're talking about Western medicine, like physical medicine, like my mom's an internist and emergency room physician, I think functional medicine doctors are great for a lot of things. I think people who can go to those kind of more holistic folks who are MDs and have Western medicine medical training, but who also have more of kind of an Eastern approach. A lot of them are trained in Chinese medicine or different kinds of, as you mentioned, Ayurvedic principles and things like that. I think they can be really enormously helpful as far as the medical model medicine, like my arm, my rash, my broken elbow, as far as mental health, emotional
well-being.
Yeah,
that's what I was going towards. Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of thing. Like I said, I'm trained in a bunch of modalities that Western therapists have come up with and scientists have come up with, like somatic experiencing, internal family systems, focusing oriented therapy, coherence therapy, advanced experiential dynamic therapy, relational life therapy, all these different things. But they're all just amalgamations of other kind of shamanistic indigenous principles that have existed long, long before and do still exist in other communities and other forms in many different other ways. So the wisdom is there. These are just ways of packaging it that are kind of marketable to a mass Western audience and kind of broken down in intelligible enough little bites for people to be able to offer. So when I offer them to people now, the goal is to be able to allow them to get to what it is that's the root of what is under the surface, right? So your tree is here, the earth is here, the roots are here. Most people spend a lot of time with the leaves and the branches and maybe the bark or maybe the trunk. Rarely is there a lot of stuff that goes in here that then can actually deal with what's happening here. And this is networked, by the way, to other roots. So this is intergenerational trauma, ancestral connection, different kinds of things. So you have to really kind of understand and be curious about what is beyond the naked eye, if you will. And once we sort of start to get down there, that gets back to our original point about the emotional truth of something. Once we get down there, we find out what the emotional truth is, then we can bring it up and that stopped process, that trauma is relieved or unburdened or allowed to settle energetically. And then something new can be born, a new way of acting, a new way of feeling, a new way of being. And so that's sort of what I try to offer people, the adults and the couples that I work with, either in coaching or psychotherapy.
Yeah, I think 33% of Americans are on some type of antidepressant or anti-anxiety drug, but yet hospitalizations continue to go up. So I think that shows you that, unfortunately, the model of diagnose, label, and give prescription medication just doesn't really work so well.
Yeah, I mean, diagnosis is a way of describing a cluster of symptoms that really is sort of random. It could exist for different reasons in different people. I personally hate the whole diagnostic sort of piece of being a licensed psychotherapist. I am much more interested in how one's own personal adaptive system got whatever it learned, and then allowing that to rewrite its own history in terms of what would be a corrective or favorable experience using that own individual's imagination. So that's why I love this work, is because there is absolutely a way out, but it's funny, if you don't have access to your imagination, you can't really do it. And so being able to imagine only happens when you're able to be creative and a little bit playful. And that requires that you feel safe, which if you had an abusive or neglectful childhood, sometimes it takes a while to establish that sense of safety so that you feel safe enough with the practitioner that you're working with to be able to then start to create new ideas or imaginations that then can be used to help offer yourself a corrective experience.
Love it. So what do you do now to help people, and how can people reach you if they're interested in getting your help?
Yeah, I mean, if they want to work with me, you're welcome to give them my website. It's worldwideweb.maximeclarity.com. That's just my last name, M like Mary, A-X, I, M like Mary, E like email, and then clarity, like I'm seeing clearly, I have clarity in my life, C-L-A-R-I-T-Y. So Maxime, M-A-X-I-M-E, clarity, C-L-A-R-I-T-Y.com. And they can shoot me an email there or book a free brief consultation on Zoom video with me and learn more and see if there's anything that I might be able to support them with.
So is there a specific person or like a something that they're dealing with that's better than, or how do you narrow down? Can you just help everybody?
I mean, you can only help anybody who's interested in being open enough to the fact that the way they've been doesn't define who they are. Like, people think that they have a personality, and I try to tell people how we've had to be isn't who we really are.
Love it.
So don't mistake the amalgamation of strategies for survival with your deeper essential self and this expansiveness that you have access to that unfortunately got narrowed and limited based on traumatic stress and other kinds of experiences that at one time you just didn't have the capacity to navigate. And so you either had to push them away or you were going to be too overwhelmed by them. So kudos to you for surviving and being here, whoever you are out there. If you're listening to this, kudos to all of that. I'm grateful for those strategies. And now also we can meet them from a space of accompaniment and a friendly curiosity and being able to unpack those little more tender parts inside of us and bring them more up to date in the present day. So can I help anybody or everybody? I don't know. I think the process is pretty universal. If you're interested in being able to access your imagination for healing, I think that it is possible. Yeah.
Love it. Love it. And final question, what do you think is your greatest lesson that you've learned in your life?
Oh, boy. I don't know if it's a lesson. I'm not afraid of myself. I have a capacity to accompany my own experience and my own feelings and emotions in a way that was never accessible to me before I sort of was introduced to this work. So I'm a friend to myself in a way today that I never used to be. And I would like to like just be a hope merchant to others that you can be a friend to yourself in a way that's non-performative, non-toxic positivity, but a genuine friend to yourself in a way that isn't overly permissive either, that upholds the sort of core principles of good parenting: nurture, limits, and guidance. And from that place, have a lot of self-love and self-compassion that is yielding and flexible and kind, but also firm and boundaried and respectful.
Love it. I have a shirt. I don't have it on today. It says, be your own best friend. It has a big smiley face. Today I've got, no one can love you like you can. And when you learn that and you start to love yourself, wow, does the world ever change?
It's a different ballgame.
Francesca, thanks so much. That was amazing. Your experience and insight was quite amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad. It was a pleasure to be here. Take care, everyone, and feel free to reach out on MaximateClarity.com if you'd like to connect.
And don't forget, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people change their lives by discovering freedom and happiness by reversing these limiting beliefs that are buried in us. So please, if you like the show, share it, subscribe it, rate it, whatever you can do to get it out. And until next time, remember, love heals all. Thanks.
Hit subscribe if you don't want to miss out on more life-changing content. And if you're struggling, you don't have to. Go to bradchandler.com/contact There, you can join the Facebook community of like-minded entrepreneurs, and you'll see a button to schedule your freedom and happiness call. See you on the next episode.